Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. At various points in the history of the United States, certain intellectual leaders have changed the way Americans think about important issues, like education, democracy, and justice. Such was the case in the years following the Civil War. We explore that era and its intellectual leaders this week with Louis Menand. And later in the show, James Muldoon takes up the subject of globalization, the roots of which he finds not in the contemporary, but in the medieval world. Before we get to those subjects, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On July 16, 1918, the Bolsheviks executed Russian Tsar Nicholas II, his wife, and their five children. The last Russian royal family fell victim to the October Russian Revolution. Nicholas followed his father to the throne in 1896, but he was unprepared for the task that lay ahead of him as the ruler of a vast empire and gradually incurred widespread opposition to his autocratic rule. The outbreak of World War I temporarily rallied Russian support for the monarchy, but Nicholas did little to maintain his people's confidence. He interfered with the decisions of his military leaders and then left for the front to take command of the army himself. The losses continued, and in his absence, the Tsar's wife took up with the disreputable spiritual and faith healer Rasputin. The Russian people were outraged, as were others at court, who killed Rasputin, but the damage had been done. Riots broke out in St. Petersburg. The army refused Nicholas's orders to restore peace, and Nicholas was forced to abdicate. The former Tsar and his family were taken to a secret location in the Urals, where they were killed and their bodies burned and hastily buried in unmarked graves. A team of scientists located the family's remains in 1976, but kept the discovery secret until after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Romanovs were given a state funeral in 1998, reburied in St. Petersburg's Cathedral of St. Peter and Paul, and were canonized in 2002 by the Russian Orthodox Church. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the American Film Institute, as part of its ongoing centennial celebration and its listing of the top films of the past 100 years in various categories, recently announced its top 100 U.S. love stories. Not surprisingly, Casablanca was number one, followed closely by Gone with the Wind. Rounding out the top 10 are West Side Story, Roman Holiday, An Affair to Remember, The Way We Were, Dr. Zhivago, It's a Wonderful Life, Love Story, and City Lights. Also, historians are racing against the clock to collect as many veteran stories as possible on video and audio tape for posterity. The Veterans History Project of the U.S. Library of Congress, launched this past D-Day anniversary, hopes to gather the raw material for a more comprehensive history than any ever written about a nation at war. There are about 19 million war veterans in the U.S., but those who fought in World War II and the Korean War and their stories are being lost at a rate of about 1,200 a day. This is Talking History. Louis Menand won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize in History for his book, The Metaphysical Club, A Story of Ideas in America. Talking History's Fred Nielsen recently spoke to Menand about his award-winning book.
The Civil War destroyed slavery and much more. Shattered, too, were many of the intellectual assumptions of antebellum America. In his book, The Metaphysical Club, my guest Louis Menand explores how new ideas gradually replaced the old. At the center of his story are four men: Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., Charles Peirce, William James, and John Dewey. According to Menand, their ideas changed the way Americans thought and continue to think about education, democracy, liberty, justice, and tolerance. He concludes that, as a result, these men changed the way Americans live. Louis Menand is a professor of English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Professor Menand, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks.
Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. fought in the Civil War as a young man, and you describe that experience as the central experience of his very long life. He died in 1935, shortly after retiring from the U.S. Supreme Court. What was his experience in the Civil War?
Holmes' experience really was, in many ways, emblematic of the generational shift that took place over the course of the Civil War, between the pre-war and the post-war generations. He was a Bostonian. He was a Boston Brahmin. In fact, his father, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., is the man who coined the term Boston Brahmin. So he was very much of the cream of Boston society in the pre-war era. He was a Harvard student. He was very idealistic. In fact, he was an abolitionist, very active in supporting the abolitionists in Boston. So when Fort Sumter was fired on in 1861, he was a senior at Harvard, and he dropped out to enlist in the Union Army, and he did so in a spirit of moral crusade. Knowles was a very bookish young man, not particularly strong physically, tall but very skinny, and he went off to fight without really any idea what war would involve, and he had a really violent and frightening experience. He was wounded three times in all, in three separate engagements, twice seriously, once through the chest, once in the neck. The third time he was wounded was in the foot, and he actually hoped that his foot would have to be amputated so he could be discharged. He saw many of his friends shot and killed in front of his eyes. Many other friends were killed over the course of the war. So when he came out of the war after 3 years in the Army, he was deeply disillusioned. And this disillusionment really colors everything he wrote in his career as a judicial philosopher and a judge. What the effect of the war on Holmes wasn't just to make him reassess his beliefs, the beliefs that had taken him into the war in 1861, but it made him rethink his belief about beliefs. It made him change his notion of what ideas were. And the easiest way to put that change, I think, and I think this is really describes generally what happened to the intellectuals in the post-war period I try to write about in my book, the easiest way to put that change is to say that he came to see that ideas are provisional tools that people use, that beliefs are provisional responses to particular circumstances, and that there's always reasons why, concrete reasons why, different kinds of personalities and different kinds of situations come up with different kinds of beliefs. He tried to take beliefs, in other words, not to debunk them, but to bring them down to a human level and to treat them as instruments of action rather than as absolutes.
William James is a friend of Holmes, although he has a very different wartime experience. Unlike Holmes, he doesn't serve in the Army. How did the war affect James?
Well, James, it's interesting that James and Holmes were best friends after the war for about 6 or 7 years, and they used to get together every Saturday night at 8:30 with a bottle of rum to talk about the nature of the universe. And their correspondence, when they weren't in town together, they would write to each other, is full of tremendous affection. It's odd because William James is almost the opposite temperamentally of Holmes. Holmes was a rather severe intellect, rather cynical, rather austere and cold. James was the opposite. He was very sponge-like. He was very warm, and he could never make up his mind, so he was constantly shuttling back and forth between one option and another option. His whole life is characterized by this kind of dithering. So when the war came up, James was certainly of an age to enlist, but he couldn't make up his mind for several years about whether he should or not, and ultimately stayed out of the war and was a student at Harvard during the period that the war was fought. But two of his younger brothers, Wilkie James and Bob James, both did enlist. They lied about their age. They were so young to get into the Army, and they served in all black regiments, and they both had very traumatic war experiences, particularly Wilkie, who was badly wounded in the assault on Fort Wagner. That's the assault of the famous all-black regiment, the Massachusetts 54th, that they made the movie Glory from. And it really ruined Wilkie's life. He died at the age of 38, suffering from a lot of illnesses and wounds related to the war, and felt very cast out. And I think this profoundly affected William James, so that his own experience of the war, you know, personally was nothing like Holmes's. But like everyone who lived through it, no matter how closely involved they were in it, it affected their lives. I think we can think about it sort of like the Vietnam period. I mean, even most people didn't go to Vietnam, but even if you were here and of a certain age during the Vietnam War, you were affected by the experience of the war, and the Civil War was the same.
You take the title of your book from a short-lived group called the Metaphysical Club. What exactly was that group?
Well, the Metaphysical Club is a semi-legendary group that met in Cambridge, Massachusetts for about 9 or 10 months in 1872. It was a philosophy discussion group, and not very much is known about it because there's really no paper trail of the club itself. We don't really know exactly how many people belonged to it or how often they met or even what they discussed. But we do know that we know three of the members of the club were William James, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and the third man, Charles Sanders Peirce, who is now much less, of course, well-known than the other two, but was in his day considered a kind of genius of science and philosophy, was a contemporary of Holmes and James's. And the reason that the Metaphysical Club has this semi-legendary status is because it's supposed to have been, in the discussions of the group, that Charles Peirce first coined the term pragmatism, which was revived many years later by William James, in fact, in 1898, to become America's single contribution to philosophy, the philosophy of pragmatism.
The essence of pragmatism, as Peirce and James especially talked about it, is that truth is not something abstract, unchanging out there. It's something that can change, and as James insists, truth is something that ought to be judged by whether an idea should be judged by whether it has, in his term, cash value, whether it's useful or not. How do they come to believe in this idea of pragmatism?
Well, I think the main influence really was Charles Darwin. You remember that On the Origin of Species was published in 1859, just really about 14 or 15 months before the war broke out, and obviously had a tremendous effect on intellectual life in every area. In the case of philosophy, I think the influence was this. Why do we have minds? Well, we have minds because we use them to form beliefs or ideas about the world. Well, how do we know whether those beliefs are true? What is the test of the truth of a belief? In traditional philosophy, the mind is figured as a kind of mirror, so that a belief is true if it mirrors accurately the way things really are, if it's an accurate representation of, an objective representation of the external world. Now, on a Darwinian theory, there's no adaptive utility to having a mirror in our heads. That can't really be the reason why we form beliefs, just to make an accurate picture. On a Darwinian theory, if we have the capacity to form beliefs, it's because that capacity helps us to adapt. So the pragmatists were merely saying the test of the truth of a belief or idea about the world is that it puts us into a better relation with the world. It helps us adapt to it. As you say, James used the term cash value. It cashes out for us in experience. It makes a difference. If it doesn't make a difference, then there's no reason to have it. So what they really were doing, I think, is applying a kind of theory of natural selection to epistemology, to philosophy of knowledge, and coming up with a different explanation for what beliefs are.
Jefferson and many of the other founders following John Locke invoke the laws of nature, of nature's God. They speak of natural rights as being things that come to us at birth. We are born as individuals, free and independent. And yet Holmes and the philosopher John Dewey, who was born in the same year as Darwin's book, insist that Jefferson is wrong. They seem almost to turn him on his head. Rights are not natural. They exist not for individuals, but for the good of society. What leads them to this change?
Well, you're right. Both Holmes and Dewey, who Dewey is a bit younger than the other three people we've talked about, but he's the sort of public philosopher of this school of thought. Both Holmes and Dewey had a great impact on American freedom. Holmes through his Supreme Court decisions upholding the freedom of expression, and Dewey through his championship of the principle of academic freedom. But they didn't, as you say, they didn't think of freedoms in the traditional sort of Declaration of Independence sense as natural rights that people have by virtue of being human. They thought the justification for freedoms have to be because allowing people freedom of expression or academic freedom is a social good, not because it's good for the individual or respects the individual, but because society needs the ideas. And that's a very important element of their thought. One thing we might say about the relationship with Jefferson, though, who's, you know, seems to be a philosopher of natural rights, is although a person like Dewey would be very skeptical of the natural rights talk in Jefferson, Jefferson, in fact, was the one founding father Dewey had a respect for. And that reflects another side of this school of thought that we're talking about, which is the interest in democracy as the fundamental value in all kinds of social activity. And Jefferson was a radical Democrat, and his view of democracy was really what we call participatory democracy today. And that was very much Dewey's view. So the, you know, what freedom of speech is about the democratic society tolerating difference of expression so that, in Holmes's term, the marketplace of ideas can weed out the bad ideas, weed out the beliefs that we don't need or that aren't good for us so that we can arrive in a consensual way at a better belief.
How would, you've alluded to this already, we might explore it in more detail. How would the members of the Metaphysical Club and Dewey have us understand democracy?
Well, I think just that. In other words, that their notion of democracy was fundamentally participatory. It was very important, and this is a very important notion because the thought of all of these figures really emerged around 1900 and between 1900 and 1917, and that's a period when the country was adjusting to what we call now corporate capitalism or finance capitalism. That is a social and economic system which is characterized by large institutions, large corporate structures, in which individuals can feel, you know, disempowered. And I think that their notion of democracy was that individuals should think of themselves as active agents in making the world they live in, not just as passive atoms blown about by determinist laws. So that democracy is, in the end, the value that underlies all other values, because we can't say anything is good unless we've said that everybody has had an opportunity to contribute to making it. So it is, I think, this school of thought is radically democratic underneath, and that's what I think gives it its persistent appeal to Americans.
And yet that appeal is not always at the same level. The influence of Holmes, Peirce, James, and Dewey seems, as you note, to decline after World War II during the Cold War, only later to be revived. What accounts, first of all, for its decline after 1945 and then its later revival?
Yeah, after 1945, Holmes, Dewey, and James, who really in many ways dominated American intellectual life for 50 years, kind of went into eclipse, and relatively little was written about them. They weren't taught very much. I mean, of course, there are exceptions, but if you compare to the earlier part of the century, they seem to be somewhat discredited. I think some of that has to do with the nature of Cold War thinking, because the Cold War was a war of principle, and it was a war about the immutability of free institutions and human rights and so forth. That was the position that the United States stood for. So a philosophy that emphasizes the provisionality and fallibility and contingency of our values is not really a philosophy that's in sync with the moral imperatives of a Cold War period. And it's interesting that really the revival of interest in Holmes, James, and Dewey, and even in Peirce, took place really after the end of the Cold War. In fact, during the period I was writing the book in the 1990s, the more biographies and more collected editions and more books about James, Holmes, Peirce, and Dewey and the pragmatists came out than probably had come out in the previous 40 years.
I'm curious about the effect of the events of September 11th on the pragmatists and their reputation. We seem now to be engaged in a war of absolutes, or at least against people who preach absolutes. What effect does that event, the ongoing conflict with terrorism, have on pragmatism?
Well, pragmatism has an uneasy relation to war. I mean, one way to think about the original pragmatists is to say they were reacting against the Civil War, and they were trying to come up with a way of thinking about beliefs that would prevent people from becoming violent and going to war over beliefs. But if you think about, and I don't know, obviously nobody can say now, what really the cultural upshot of September 11th and the aftermath will be. It would just be presumptuous to speculate. But it is one thing we might say now is that we're in a paradoxical position as Americans in saying that we wish to defend and even to die for the belief that no one should be made to die because of a belief. And that is kind of the paradox of American life, that what we're protecting really doesn't boil down to an absolute, even though we absolutely believe that it should be protected.
Well, Professor Menand, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Louis Menand, the author of The Metaphysical Club, A Story of Ideas in America.
globalization is all the talk these days. Some welcome it, others condemn it, but nearly all believe it is a relatively recent phenomenon. Not so, reports James Muldoon.
Globalization is upon us, spreading an enormous range of goods and services throughout the world. Even its critics often dress like American sports fans and wave signs written in American English, the language of the global village. Globalization is, however, more than a universal consumer culture. It is possible to wear Western clothes, use Western technology, and watch CNN while rejecting the culture that underlies them. Fundamentally, globalization is a vision of the right order of the world, a vision derived from Europe's medieval Christian past. It exists not only because Europeans created worldwide trade networks, but also because Europeans conceived of all mankind as forming a universal community. Globalism and related terms such as developed and underdeveloped nations, however, mask what is really taking place. These bland terms suggest a natural, universal, and process of development, a process based upon the premise that human beings form a single species, and therefore every human society should develop along the same general lines. To label some societies as underdeveloped suggests that outside forces have blocked or slowed the natural course of development. Globalization also means that there are universal standards of behavior, what medieval thinkers labeled natural law. What is now happening is not, however, some inevitable natural process leading to the formation of similar societies everywhere, but the Westernization or Europeanization, not simply the Americanization, of the world, a process that began not in 1492, but in the 11th century. This does not simply mean the military or economic domination of the world. It means the spread of European culture and its imposition on or adoption by non-European peoples. Globalization means seeing the world as medieval European Christians saw it, a vision of mankind as a single spiritual and legal community. Modernization and globalization identify the millennium-old process in the course of which European Christian society expanded beyond its original home. To a medievalist, the vision of a universal human community with universal standards of behavior and an agency authorized to determine whether or not a society is adhering to those standards is reminiscent of the medieval papacy's conception of the world. Long ago, Karl Becker argued that the 18th century philosophes' ideas about the political order were a secularized version of medieval Christian thought. Is it possible that the same can be said of postmodern conceptions of world order? Is the postmodern vision of the world order really a revival of some very pre-modern ideas in secular guise?
You've been listening to James Muldoon, research scholar at Brown University's John Carter Brown Library. Muldoon is the author of The Expansion of Europe, Popes, Lawyers, and Infidels, and Empire in Order, The Concept of Empire, 800 to 1800. This is Talking History. For our Site of the Week segment this summer, we've been recommending historic places you might visit while on vacation. Here to tell you about one of the nation's most historic cities is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Boston, the city known as the home of the Boston Tea Party and the birthplace of the American Revolution, is most often recognized for its role in U.S. history. Founded in 1630 by English Puritans, Boston was primarily a village of farmers, craftsmen, and ministers. It rapidly expanded, serving as the main seaport for ships bound for England and the West Indies. It became the largest British settlement on the continent, but all was not well. The colonists resented the presence of the British soldiers and taxes, and hence the Tea Party. The North End neighborhood of Boston is home to several landmarks along the Freedom Trail. the three-mile path that leads visitors to some of Boston's most famous sites, including the Old State House, the site of the Boston Massacre, Benjamin Franklin's birthplace, and one of the homes of Paul Revere. And don't miss the USS Constitution, better known as Old Ironsides, the oldest commissioned warship in the U.S. Navy. The ship, which is just over 200 years old, offers spectacular views of Boston. Visitors can tour the decks and living quarters of the ship in the Charleston Navy Yard. And don't miss the library, with its impressive French and religious murals, vaulted ceilings, and marble staircase. It is the oldest public library in the country. Plan ahead if you are coming to Boston, as many facilities are booked in advance, especially during graduation time and the fall foliage season.
And finally, in preparation for your trip to Boston, we call your attention to a website that will help you prepare for one of the must-see sites in that city, Bunker Hill. Before you visit the famous battlefield, take a look at a newly created website devoted to the Battle of Bunker Hill. The online exhibit, created by the Massachusetts Historical Society, includes an essay by historian Bernard Balin, a timeline, first-hand manuscript accounts of the battle, biographical sketches of its participants, maps, and even a bibliography. Check it out at masshist.org. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.